It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest tackled one of the biggest questions of the 20th century. Why did the Holocaust happen?
But first, Brett Halsey, a Democratic state representative, threw his hat into the ring yesterday for the 2014 Wisconsin governor's race.
Halsey, who's been described as colorful and eccentric, says he'll reverse a number of recent Republican policies if elected, including Act 10. He has vowed to make the race more entertaining.
Joining us to look at what Halsey's candidacy could mean for the race and for Democrats in particular is Kenneth Mayer, professor of political science at the UW-Madison and affiliate faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to talk to you.
So we have Brett Halsey entering the race. How is this going to change things, do you think?
I actually don't think it's going to change things all that much. Well, what we have now is Mary Burke running against three what you might call just curiosity candidates. And of the three of them, Halsey is the one that has the most political experience. But I would be very surprised if any of them wind up having a material effect on the Democratic primary.
What about the argument that maybe having more challengers in the ring for the primary stage in particular sort of enhances the effects of democracy? Will it do that, maybe?
Well, it's certainly possible. It's conceivable that the candidates might push Burke a little bit and force her, as Halsey put it, to sharpen her game. But for that to work, you generally need to have reasonably credible candidates who have a realistic shot of winning. And not only are these three candidates not in that category, I'd be surprised if any of them get more than a trivial percentage of the vote.
Now, here we are. It's almost May. Is this considered late to be getting into the race?
Well, for these candidates, sure. And for Halsey, this is late. I mean, we're about 6 weeks removed from the time when the nominating petitions have to be submitted to get on the ballot. And I think that's indicative of the fact that I think if you asked Halsey, he would tell you that he doesn't have a chance to win. He's doing it presumably to put issues on the agenda, to talk about things that he wants to talk about. The other two candidates, we really haven't heard a peep from.
And are you expecting any other challengers to enter at this point? You mentioned a couple of other curiosity candidates. We haven't heard a peep from the others in the field, but anyone else do you think is likely to join at this point?
Well, probably not. There have been a number of potential candidates who have decided not to run, and these would be people who are more well-known statewide. They have more political experience, and the time to be thinking about these challenges would be late 2013, a year or so ahead. It's going to be difficult for anybody to meaningfully challenge Burke for the nomination. We're just getting too close to the primary.
And let's talk about the candidates you called curiosity candidates, and I think you're including Halsey a bit in that number. What is that, and what sort of function do they play in a race like this?
Well, in a relatively open system, it's possible for anybody to declare that they're going to be a candidate. And of the two other candidates, Marsha Mercedes Perkins, as best I can tell, she doesn't even have a website. And Hari Trivedi, who's a physician in Milwaukee, was an independent candidate in the 2012 recall, but these are people that have zero political experience. They have raised very little money, if at all, and I just don't think that they are going to have much of an impact. They don't have an opportunity to get their message out. They don't really even have a message, and that's not true of Halsey. He does have a message, but I suspect for him, not many people outside of Madison will have heard of him, and for people outside of Madison who have, the stories that they're going to remember about him are the stories from 2013, which are frankly erratic. We're talking about the disorderly conduct citation, the stories about his own aide saying that she was afraid of him when he was talking about bringing box cutters and muskets into the Capitol. And this is not the foundation for a serious campaign.
Do you expect him to garner any support? He is saying some things that some on the left would like to hear a candidate say. So is it possible that he could shear some of Mary Burke's support away?
It's possible. Between Halsey and Burke, she is trying to steer a somewhat moderate course. She's been a little cagey about Act 10, not saying that she would want to overturn it. She's been cautious about some other issues like concealed carry, and Halsey is just straight down the left side, and his announcement yesterday, spending billions of dollars on infrastructure, overturning Act 10, and refunding contributions that state employees have had to make. And it's conceivable that you might get some people on the left side of the Democratic spectrum to support him. But I really don't think it's going to be a significant percentage of the Democratic primary voter.
And as far as Governor Walker and the race that he's running, is there any chance that he will deflect his attention a little bit, or his spotlight, is he still going to be focusing strictly on Mary Burke?
We're not going to hear a peep from him about this. He's already said that, or a spokesman has said that that doesn't change his focus. And I think the strategy for Burke is just to ignore these candidacies and focus on her message, and I think you'll very clearly see the same from Walker, not to really get involved.
Now, if, as you say, Halsey doesn't seem to stand a chance and he's not really going to affect the races that Mary Burke and Governor Walker are running, why is he in the race? What do you think he can bring to it? Is he just trying to highlight some issues?
Well, I think that's that's the key. There are some issues that he thinks are important. Some of the issues that presumably he thinks that Burke is ignoring, and that's actually not unknown for candidates to get involved in these races, not because they think they can win, but because they want to participate in the discussion. And so in that sense, it's nothing particularly unusual about it. But again, I would be very surprised if any of these three candidates wind up having a material effect on the primary.
Why do you suppose we aren't seeing more prominent challengers to Mary Burke?
Well, that's the more interesting question. I think one of the answers is that there are a lot of people who think that Walker's going to be tough to defeat. As a candidate who has lots of experience, you wouldn't want to step into a situation that you didn't think was favorable. By all accounts, 2014 is going to be very difficult for Democrats. You have a midterm election with a relatively unpopular president. You have Republicans mobilized. You have the Governor Walker presiding over a slowly improving state and national economy. And I think the strategic context of the race is going to be difficult for Democrats. Not insurmountable, but it certainly is not the situation where a Democratic candidate is looking at this race and thinking that this is a real opportunity.
Do you see the fact of Brett Halsey entering the race as either helping or hurting Democrats' chances in the November election, or maybe neither?
Well, I don't think it's going to have a significant effect. It could play out. It could wind up helping Burke by allowing her to run down the middle and portray herself as someone who is more moderate than typical Democrats. It is conceivable, although unlikely, that Halsey may wind up pushing her, and if he starts to, in the unlikely event he starts getting some traction, he may force her to respond. But I think my guess, and again, it's not even clear that he's going to get the 2,000 signatures necessary to get on the ballot. My guess is that this is not a candidacy that's going to have a sustained effect, that it's going to change the dynamics of the race.
And we'll leave it there. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Kenneth Mayer, professor of political science at the UW-Madison. He's affiliate faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs.
The Holocaust, the systematic killing of 6 million Jews by Germany's Nazi regime, stands as one of the most horrific events in human history. But why did it happen?
In the 7 decades since the Holocaust, some historians have said it's unexplainable, and some people have said we shouldn't try to explain it and risk justifying what happened.
Our next guest takes a different view. He says it's vital that we try to come to grips with what led to the Holocaust. Dan McMillan has been exploring this issue for years. He shares his thoughts in his new book, How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, there's been a reluctance to try to explain this. You quote Holocaust survivor Primo Levi warning that, quote, to understand is almost to justify. You don't agree. Why?
Well, because I think that if there's one thing that we've learned, well, there's a lot of things we've learned studying the Holocaust, but that every participant, or at least every German participant in the Holocaust, acted entirely with free will, faced no threat whatsoever of punishment. Indeed, often was even explicitly assured that no punishment would follow if they refused to obey an order to kill. It was always possible, indeed easy, to opt out of killing if you didn't want to do so. So no amount of explanation can relieve these people of their moral responsibility. So that isn't a concern for me.
While there were other genocidal killings in the 20th century, you say the Holocaust was a genocide like no other. What sets it apart?
I guess what sets it apart is that the Holocaust was an absolutely complete negation of the idea that human life has any kind of inherent worth and meaning. And I guess what I mean by that, to give sort of concrete examples of that, it's the only genocide in which the population was targeted for complete biological extinction. The only time that an ethnic group was targeted for complete extinction, I mean, not only did they plan to kill the 11 million that they thought lived in Europe, but had they won the war in Europe and had been strong enough to overcome the U.S., we generally agree that the next step would have been to strike at every single Jewish population on Earth. They looked at Jews as if they were kind of like smallpox, a virus that you had to eradicate everywhere so it would never grow back. And that's kind of one example. The other example, I guess, is sort of the radical way that they denied their victims humanity, like by reducing them to the status of material objects and by characterizing them as vermin, as microbes, as bacilli, and so on. So those would be some of the concrete examples.
So starting to touch on some of the explanations people have offered over the years, was this something uniquely about the German people, about German culture?
I argue pretty strongly against that. I mean, there clearly are reasons why it happened in Germany and not elsewhere, and they're really rooted in some very specific flaws in the political system and also in a lot of bad luck that made it impossible for Germany to establish democracy until relatively late in the game, until 1918, and that and other factors helped explain how someone like Hitler could come into power. But historians, tried for decades to figure out if there was something sort of uniquely pathological or wrong with the Germans, and by the middle of the 1990s, we kind of all gave up on that.
Why were Jews targeted specifically? Anti-Semitism, of course, was nothing new to Nazi Germany, centuries even of anti-Semitic pogroms and other killings, banishments, things like that. But why the Jews specifically in the Nazi Holocaust?
You know, there were so many different types of anti-Semitism in Germany and in Europe at the time, but there was one particular strand that led very directly to the Holocaust already and already kind of began in the 1890s, and that was the accusation that the Jews were the creators of Marxism, that they were responsible for the existence of socialist and communist parties, and that Jews controlled an international conspiracy to dominate the nations of the world by sort of dividing and conquering, by setting social class against social class, by promoting Marxism, by promoting the Marxist theory of class struggle. And the question is why were the Jews a likely target for this kind of fantasy about them as the leaders of this international conspiracy? One was simply that Karl Marx was of Jewish ancestry, and that's a convenient peg to hang it on. A second is that there had been a long Christian tradition of seeing the Jews as kind of the spawn of Satan, and you can see these secular conspiracy theories as kind of an echo of this earlier Christian idea of the Jews as this ultimate evil. A third point is that the Jews were an international minority with, communities in every European country, and that kind of lent a service plausibility to the idea that they could coordinate across national borders in a conspiracy. And I guess the last was just that they were so successful in so many endeavors, and in particular in Germany in the years before World War One in the media. They were very, very prominent in newspaper and book publishing, and that gave rise to fears of Jewish influence and the idea that the Jews had the ability to set the political agenda and promote Marxism through their newspapers. So I think those are kind of the obvious factors that might explain that.
And I always wonder about the impact of nationalism, and a particularly radical nationalism, where you're defining this category of, in this case, Germanhood, and then you've got these people who don't fit your definition of Germanhood. In this case, the Jews. This also often applied to the Romani, commonly known as Gypsies, Masons, and others. Was that? Do you think that was part of the explanation of why there was a convenient scapegoat there?
Yeah, you know, I think the way that worked was that the biggest political problem in Germany from the 1880s down to 1918, where Germany is. It was called the German Empire, and it was an authoritarian political system where most of the power lay with a hereditary emperor, the Kaiser. And starting in the 1880s, there was a very threatening challenge to this political system from the Socialist Party, the German Socialist Party that was the largest in Europe and that was very radical. And Germany's ruling class and its imperial government pursued a strategy of trying to contain socialism and trying to prevent its spread by, in effect, saying to Germans, to the German people, let's not be workers, let's not be middle class, let's not be upper class, let's not be aristocracy, let's just all be German and unite on the basis of what we have in common, which is our German blood. And one way to define the German blood is to say, well, the Jews don't belong to it, they're not of our blood. And let's pull together, let's unite as Germans against our enemies, and thus you had a very aggressive nationalistic foreign policy that was an important cause of World War One. And at home, this was part of the use of the accusation that the Jews were responsible for Marxism. The Jews are the enemy because they are dividing us against each other. Let's all us Germans pull together against people who are not German, including the Jews. I think that's kind of how it worked politically.
There's a long-running debate in history between the role of big forces and the role of prominent individuals. And I want to bring up Adolf Hitler here. Would the Holocaust have, I mean, it's hard to answer a question like this, but would the Holocaust have happened without him?
That's one point. You know, you're always on shaky ground when you talk about things that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But historians are usually reluctant to engage in counterfactuals, but you can ask just almost any important historian of the Holocaust or Nazi Germany. They all agree without Hitler, the Holocaust simply could not have happened. So he didn't do it all by himself. He had a lot of help, and there are so many other factors in hundreds of thousands of, to some extent, tens of millions of Germans who bore some responsibility. But it is true, without Hitler, it couldn't have happened. And if, for example, he'd been killed in a nearly successful assassination attempt in the fall of 1939, we probably would not have had World War II in Europe, and we certainly would have had the Holocaust.
And he tied together a lot of the threads you were bringing up earlier, the anti-Semitism, the anti-communism. Also, you write about his desire for Lebensraum, room for the German people to live in Eastern Europe, where many Jews and where a communist government was. He was the one who synthesized it all together in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, he pulled it together in a synthesis that I think most people at the time would not have found terribly impressive intellectually, but he was in keeping. There were a lot of other people on the right wing of German politics and also in the military who talked about the need for Lebensraum, that is living space, in the East, taking territory away from Poland and from the Soviet Union so that the Germans could settle and breed large families and make Germany larger and militarily stronger. His synthesis, pulling it all together, I don't think would have impressed anyone except that he was in charge of Germany and he was able to act on it and implement it.
You mentioned the couple hundred thousand people who were part of this genocidal effort. If you took everyday decent people, maybe from our place and time, United States 2014, you put them in a situation like Nazi Germany, is there something inherently about us that would step back and say, no, we're not going to do this? Or in that context, would we react any better than the Germans of the 30s and 40s?
Well, if we actually grew up in that context, we wouldn't be ourselves. Mm. We wouldn't be we. I mean, I think if somehow someone could crazily establish a dictatorship in America today, but with the American people being as we are today, with our commitment to democracy and to equal rights and the protection of the rights of minorities, such a dictator, no matter how powerful, could not find people to participate in a genocide and would not find that the American people would be willing to tolerate it. I think in that sense, and I think that's equally true of Germany today as well. if that answers your question.
But the people of Germany weren't uniquely monstrous. They were in a specific place and time that led them to something like the Holocaust.
I think it is true that the political development of Germany from the 1880s down to the point when Hitler took power was already very destructive, and you know, anti-Semitism had become a political issue in a way that it never was here, and the German people, a lot of them were nationalistic in a way that was ugly and dangerous. That's never been the case here. But nonetheless, I think it's when looking at, I view the Holocaust as unique, but it seems to me that in explaining it, it's not that the Germans are unique, it's that the circumstances in which they found themselves.
We'll have to leave it there. Dan McMillan, author of How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. Bill McKibben has been observing and writing about climate change for a quarter century. He's one of the nation's leading environmentalists. His 1988 book, The End of Nature, is seen as the first book for a general audience about climate change.
We spoke to him a couple of weeks before Earth Day and asked him to look back and tell us how he saw the state of the planet right now, a quarter century later.
We have, by this point, hundreds of thousands of powerful scientific data points that bring home exactly how badly we've screwed up. In the last day of March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's biggest collection of climate scientists, issued their latest report, and they said climate change is no longer a theoretical problem for the future. It's now breaking over us from every direction as the ocean grows more acid, as the Arctic melts, as the weather grows more erratic and extreme, as farmers begin to have significant problems growing food, as wildfires extend ever longer into the spring and the fall, as all the phenomenon that we grew to understand and be familiar with during the 10,000 years of the Holocene now enter this new, strange, hyped up, amped up, overcharged world. And of course, we're only at the beginning of it. So far, we've raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree, and that's already causing havoc, 1 degree Celsius. On current trajectories, that'll be 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit before the century is out. And if we do that, then the damage we've already seen will be as nothing. Civilization of the kind we know simply isn't possible on a planet as disrupted as we're trying to make it at this point.
And that same Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that you just mentioned, they're sort of putting it out there that we're officially, it seems, moving from how to stop climate change to how to survive it. Is that how you read the shift right now?
No, it's not. We obviously have to adapt, and as they've said, to the change we've already made. But they've also made it clear that there is no adapting to the level of change that will come unless we stop pouring more carbon into the atmosphere. We have to adapt to that which we can't prevent, but we have to prevent that to which we can't adapt. The world has set a target, a sort of red line of 2 degree temperature increase, 2 degrees Celsius, and said beyond this, we dare not go. If we did everything right from this point on, we might just be able to hold temperature increases to 2 degrees. And if we did, we would have a difficult, even miserable century, but perhaps not an impossible one. But that's going to take summoning everything we can do to get off fossil fuels in very short order and replace power our lives with completely different forms of energy. The good news is, and here's the other thing that's changed in 25 years, we now know that those forms of energy are sufficient, that they work beautifully. If you'd told me 25 years ago that there would have been days last summer when the country of Germany provided half the power it used from solar panels within its borders, I would have told you that seemed unlikely to me, especially given Germany's latitude, you know. But they've done it because they have serious political will. Think what a country could do that had, Florida, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, California within its borders.
Are you saying that based on what you've seen about the way some alternative fuel can work and things like solar panels, that we have the tools that we need already, that we're just maybe not implementing them?
That's correct. We have certainly a lot, all the tools we need to get started. And one assumes that the more solar panels we put up, the more smart people there are who will figure out how to make those solar panels work better. That's what a learning curve is all about. But we're already dropped the price of solar panels, for instance, by a factor of 90 or 95% over the last 20 years. So the progress is swift. What we now have to do is make political science work as effectively as science and engineering have worked over the last 25 years. The scientists have outlined the problem. They've reached consensus on a difficult problem in chemistry and physics. It's been a model, a triumph of the scientific method. The engineers have done a good job, too. But political science has failed about as badly as science has succeeded. And that's, you know, where we need to go to work now. And I think the reason at this point is pretty obvious. 25 years ago, many of us expected that reason would prevail, that if scientists went up, as they have year after year, to Capitol Hill and explained that the worst thing in the world that could happen was happening, our leaders would do something about it. But our leaders have failed to do much about it, and now we understand why. The enormous political power of the fossil fuel industry, the richest industry in the history of the planet, has been sufficient to prevent change from happening. And since we're never going to outspend the fossil fuel industry, those of us who want change are needing to find other currencies to work in. Those are the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we have to spend our bodies. And so that's, over the last 5 years, been the other most encouraging thing that's happened, the rise of a real movement, not yet big enough to beat the fossil fuel industry all the time, but enough at least to start to challenge them, you know. So far, they haven't been able to build the Keystone Pipeline. So far, we're beginning to see the rise of this divestment movement of colleges and churches and governments around the world getting rid of their fossil fuel stock and putting a political challenge to these heretofore all-powerful companies. So, I would not say I'm an optimist. The name of the book that I wrote about all this 25 years ago was The Cheerful End of Nature. But I would say that I'm really pleased to see that at least a large number of people have decided they're not going to go down without a fight, and who knows how that fight will come out once we get it going.
Bill, one of the things you see when you start reading about the problem of climate change is some people saying, we don't really have the science or the political will or the tools right now to do what we need to do to halt global warming, to halt climate change in its tracks. What we need to do is just cross our fingers and pray for a big technological breakthrough. What do you think of that point of view?
I think it's like saying, I've got cancer now. Chemotherapy would be expensive and it's onerous, and so I'm going to, instead of having it, I'm going to sit and wait and hope that sometime in the remaining months of my life, someone comes up with a complete new technological breakthrough that allows them to touch my forehead with a wand and make my tumors melt away. That would be nice, but one would be unwise to behave in that fashion.
Now, you mentioned politics, and you're disappointed in what we've seen so far, what's been accomplished. And when he was running, President Obama, he ran on the promise that he'd be an environmental president and he would lead in the face of the challenges posed by climate change. And you've written a lot about the administration's response to global climate change. Give us the report card for the Obama White House.
Well, I'm afraid it's nowhere near as rosy as so many of us hoped it would be. You know, I was just about the first environmentalist to sign on to this Environmentalist for Obama back in 2008. I believed the guy, and he said that this was at the center of his agenda. But within weeks of taking office, his administration summoned a bunch of environmental leaders to the White House, and they told us they weren't going to talk about climate change. They were going to talk about green jobs because it polled better. And They didn't talk about climate change, really, for 4 years. In fact, the president went through the whole 2012 campaign in the hottest year in American history without ever even mentioning climate change, neither he nor Mr. Romney. Look, we've squandered a long period of time. I think the next one of the few places that the president has to begin to show that maybe he's changing his mind is with this decision on the Keystone Pipeline, which we expect sometime this year. We'll see what he does. But, you know, in the course of his presidency, the U.S. has dramatically increased the amount of oil and coal and gas that it produces. We're shipping it all over the world. The net carbon emissions from the United States are on the rise because of that, and it's depressing.
One thing the president has said is that the U.S. needs to be at the vanguard of new energies, clean technology for fuel, and that the country that does that on the global stage will be leading the rest of them. How are we doing on that front?
I think I would invest my money in German technology at this point. They've stolen a real march on us, and the Chinese are pretty far ahead, too. These are the guys who are putting up really big facilities right now and learning the lessons that there are to learn.
Now, there have been accusations launched at the U.S. from other countries that the U.S., and not just under President Obama, but other previous administrations, has dragged its feet, has not really fully engaged in coming to the table and wanting to implement decisive measures to combat climate change. How does the U.S. look when compared to other countries?
Well, look, you can sort of almost measure it objectively. The U.S. theoretically agreed to the Kyoto Protocol, like all the other developed countries of the world in the 1990s, but all the other countries of the world went along and ratified it. We chose not to. We didn't take part. We went to Copenhagen as the 2009 was supposed to be the meeting at which the world came together to solve this problem. 2009 was the period when, you know, the U.S. was truly ascendant as the world's sole superpower. Hillary Clinton was there as Secretary of State. Barack Obama flew in as president. The meeting was an utter bust. Nothing happened. It was the climate equivalent of Munich. It couldn't have been any worse. That was the biggest foreign policy failure of the first Obama administration. He'll get another chance in his second term. The next Copenhagen is in Paris in 2015, and we'll see if they learned any lessons at all.
We're talking with author, environmentalist, and activist Bill McKibben about the state of the environment. For this Earth Day, we're talking with environmental activist and author Bill McKibben about the state of the environment. I sat down to talk with him a couple weeks ago and asked him if he had the ear of President Obama and could help him set the environmental agenda, what would he ask the president to do?
The thing would be to put a serious price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the environment. And if you did it the right way and rebated the money back to people, you'd make everybody whole. You'd start charging Exxon rent, as it were, for the atmosphere, which they should be paying. That would be a popular program, I think. In fact, the one place where it's really being done well in British Columbia, 60% of the population approves of this tax. I've never seen any polling data indicate 60% of the population approve of any tax. That's not going to happen in the foreseeable future in this country. So we need the president doing everything he can do on his own, like stopping the Keystone Pipeline. And we need him talking about this now all the time. We need him joining those of us in the streets and helping build this kind of movement. But I don't think it's likely to happen because I think he's pretty cautious and centrist about all of this, pretty engaged with the fossil fuel industry. So I expect we're going to have to build the movement outside of the walls of power. You know, though I'm a peaceable sort, I've been arrested twice, chained to the gates of the White House in the last couple of years, and I actually think it's probably more important for us to be outside than in.
Well, let's talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. Your name is one of the first that comes up in association with critics of the Keystone XL pipeline. And as you said, you spent some time in jail, or at least you were arrested. Tell us about that pipeline and what effect you think it could have on the environment.
Well, what it really is a connection up to this huge swath that they call the tar sands in Alberta. It's incredibly dirty oil, the dirtiest oil on Earth, because it's tar, really, and you have to go and heat it from underground by burning natural gas to even make it flow. But quite aside from its particular properties that make it so particularly disgusting, there's just a hell of a lot of it. It's one of the 6 or 7 huge great pools of carbon on Earth, and we've got to keep all of them that we haven't yet exploited in the ground. Yeah, we measure carbon in the atmosphere in parts per million, okay? So at the moment, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is about 400 parts per million. That's too high. The scientists think that 350 parts per million is as high as we should ever have let it get. That's why I founded a group called 350.org. But 400 is better than 540 parts per million, which is how much carbon the atmosphere would hold if you burned every bit of economically recoverable oil in Alberta. That's why we got to keep that in the ground. It's not the only place. That's why, 350 volunteers are fighting being arrested today and sitting in at the entrance to a proposed vast new coal mine in Australia. That's why we're fighting coal ports on the Pacific Northwest and on and on. But the Keystone Pipeline is an important connection to this huge pool of carbon. And it has, I think the reason it became such an iconic fight is because the president, on his own say-so, without asking John Boehner or Mitch McConnell or anybody else, could block it. And if he did, he'd become the first world leader ever to stop a big project because of its effect on the climate. That might be the thing we need to reopen those international negotiations and get somewhere in Paris next year.
And one of the rallying cries, though, that we've heard in the last, say, 10 years has been that America needs to get off its dependence on foreign oil, and a project like the Keystone XL pipeline could help us achieve that goal. How do you balance those things politically?
Well, first of all, the last time I checked, you're as near the border as I am, but the last time I checked, Canada actually is a foreign country. But the real issue here is we need to get off oil. Our energy dependence problem isn't about where fossil fuel comes from. It's about where carbon goes in the atmosphere. And we have to get off fossil fuel, and everybody else does, because there are no boundaries in the atmosphere. We've got record coal exports from the United States right now in the last few years. And wherever you burn it, the carbon raises the temperature of the whole planet. So this is a global problem, and there's no way to find security on your own anymore, if there ever was.
I want to move for a moment to talk about fracking, which is a hot-button issue here in Wisconsin, where the frack sand is mined. What is fracking's effect on the communities around frack sites and on the environment as a whole, as you see it?
Well, you wouldn't want to live near one of these things. In fact, in one of the great moments of irony this year, the CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, joined neighbors in trying to block a fracking well near his house because he didn't want to be living near it. So no one wants to live near these things. They're, of course, gross, as are the sand mining that's damaging so many beautiful environments across the upper Midwest. But the biggest problem with fracking is that it finds us a new source of hydrocarbons at precisely the moment when we don't need it. We need to be getting off coal and gas and oil, not finding whole new ways to go about it. So it's a great tragedy that we've uncovered this and started to do it. And the only people it benefits are the very few people who run gas companies, and they've made out like bandits. And bandits is really the right word when you look at the damage they've done to the landscapes and to the climate that will last for millennia.
A friend of mine watched the Al Gore documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, with their teenage kids. And they were furious afterwards that no one was stepping up and making the hard calls. Are they right to be so angry? Or is this just a really hard problem that doesn't have easy solutions?
It's a very hard problem that does have solutions. And those solutions involve standing up. to the fossil fuel industry. So your friends were, I guess, right to be angry. On the other hand, they lose that right if they don't step up themselves. There are not leaders who are going to do this for us. There's just too much money in Washington from the fossil fuel industry. That's why we have to build a movement. So if you're angry and if you want to do something about it, yes, change your light bulb. It's important, and I changed all mine. But don't think that you're solving climate change by doing that or anything else on your own. This is a structural and systemic problem. It requires structural and systemic solutions, which means organizing, which means joining together with other people. That's what we do at 350.org, and we're very hopeful that people will join us in this fight. Some of the best climate fighters in the country are in Wisconsin, and it's always a great pleasure to get out to that part of the world and see the things people are doing. So you'll have lots of company if you get in the fight.
I know that you are not just an environmental crusader, you're a father, and nobody cares more about these issues than you do. What do you tell your daughter about the Earth's future?
Well, my daughter turned 21 this month, and so of course, one of those birthdays when one thinks hard about the past and about the future. She's a smart gal, and she knows the fix that we're in, and she's done a great job organizing at her college for divestment, and she knows why we have to do these things. She also knows that it's a beautiful world that we inhabit, and on Earth Day and on every day, one of the things that we need to do is not just fight to protect it, but go out and bear witness to it. Spend a little time in its beauty. Feel the sun on your back, the breeze on your face, and look at the feel, touch the huge variety of other creatures that the good Lord put here next to us, and enjoy it all. When you do, you come back, at least if you're like me, reinvigorated for the fight to keep it going.
As we observe Earth Day today, that was Bill McKibben, author, prominent environmentalist, and activist, talking about the state of the environment.
Hey, here at Central Time, we're always looking for your feedback and your ideas for future segments. We've got a hotline. It's 855-683-5422. Particularly curious to hear your ideas for our Curious Wisconsin segment. We've covered things like, why is there a big M on the highway near Platteville? Secret tunnels under Ripon, lots of interesting, unique things. Is there something you've looked around in the state and thought, what is that? Why is that there? Call in the hotline. Tell us about it. We'll try to find someone who can tell us what it is. 855-683-5422 is the number to call. And you can find that number, or we're going to post that on our Facebook page. And while you're on Facebook or at the hotline, leave your ideas for future topics and guests for us here on Central Time.